report in session.
Thank you. You may be seated. All right, this afternoon we're here on Miguel Peña Rodriguez versus the people. May I have the intruder appearances, please?
Yes, Your Honor. John Flores, attorney registration for the 372 appearing on behalf of Mr. Peña Rodriguez.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. And for the people, please.
My GDSP, registration number 36043, representing the law.
Thank you. Counsel, this case has been set for 1 hour. That means that each of you has a half an hour. And Mr. Rosen, to the extent that you wish to reserve some time, you should do so yourself, watching the clock, if you will. All right, whenever you're ready, Mr. Rosen.
Good afternoon.
I think he did it because he's Mexican. In my law enforcement experience, I have found that Mexican men have a bravado about them, and they feel that they can take whatever they want from women. 9 times out of 10, they're guilty when accused of sexual aggression against another person. Mr. Chavez, who's Mr. Peña Rodriguez's witness in this case, his alibi witness, the only crucial witness that he presented, I don't have to believe him. He's an illegal. These are the statements that are attributed to the juror in the affidavits that were produced to the trial court. One thing I'm sure of with the law is the fact that you cannot have a fair trial unless you have an impartial adjudicator, be a judge or be a jury. When you have actual bias, especially racial bias, it destroys the fabric of any fair trial. So why then, in this case, are we here today? With such what I believe to be fairly clear evidence of racial animus and bias and prejudice. We're here because the trial court and the Court of Appeals don't agree with me, which is not all that unusual. The trial court, and the two rulings really of the trial court, which are somewhat intertwined and important for the court's consideration. One is the fact that CRA 606B prohibits the admissibility of this evidence. That you can't use what is said within a jury room, right, to invade, you can't invade their deliberations by using those statements in a post-trial motion challenging verdict on this type of case. The other was the trial court, based on its ruling on CRA 606B, carefully scripted what defense counsel could do in the way of investigation and litigation concerning this alleged actual bias. So when and if this court points to factual inadequacies in the record, right, that we don't have a factual finding about the veracity of the affiance, right, that is because of the trial court's ruling. The fact that we don't have any other evidence to present other than the affidavits, that is because of the trial court's ruling. Okay? When it got to the Court of Appeals level, not only did the Court of Appeals essentially validate the trial court's rulings on CRA 606B, it threw in a new twist, something sua sponte that wasn't even addressed by the parties. And that was that counsel for Mr. Peña Rodriguez waived his right to contest whether or not there are actually biased jurors on the panel. Now, waiver of the right to a fair trial. Ask yourself, before you allowed an express waiver of the right to a fair trial, what would the record have to look like? What would counsel have to do to come before a court and say, the guy with the white hood and the white robe who hates my client and thinks he's guilty because of his skin color, I want him on the jury panel. And that would be okay? Can you have an express waiver?
Could I draw your attention to the law that I think is applicable we'd be interested in? Let's take a look at the Harlan Bible case. We had a very short court there.
Yes, Your Honor.
The actual Bible was used to quote the Leviticus passage?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? It was
correct.
Extraneous evidence, not in evidence through a regular method that was used with the jury.
Yes, sir.
All right, so we had to sort through all that.
Yes, sir.
We had a number of cases before that.
Yes, sir.
We made very clear in that opinion, I thought, that if a juror individually had said, well, I believe God commands death for murder, that would have been all right in the jury room. Right?
Yes, sir.
Because we don't invade the deliberations of the jurors, and they can come in with their lifetime experience and background attitudes, biases, whatever it is. But I don't see how the trial court would have erred in not allowing additional exploration here when we're simply talking about something the jurors said in the jury room.
Okay. I'd love to. Two different things come up. Actually, about seven different things, but I'll try and take them in order as best I can. Okay? The Harlow decision, and I know you authored that, and I know Justice Rice had a dissent in that. There's disagreement about it. That concerns extraneous prejudicial information. Okay? In order to understand extraneous prejudicial information, I think it's important to take a step back and understand the functioning and the process of the jury trial. Okay? Parties gather information. They bring it into court. The court, with its gatekeeping function, turns that information into evidence. Jurors then take that evidence and turn it into facts. That is the process that is supposed to occur when a jury determines what facts to apply to the law. Extraneous prejudicial information subverts that and goes around that. Harlan was, you know, I just think it's been misconstrued so many times since it's been issued. Let me explain why I say that. In Harlan, there was no doubt that the Bible was extraneous to the information given to the jurors in the courtroom. There was no issue whether or not the Bible was extraneous. If I remember correctly, that wasn't the issue of contention between the two of you. The issue was whether or not there's prejudice, okay? Also, let's put this into context. This was a death penalty case, and I want to get the quote right if I can. Religion is relevant to the court-sanctioned individual moral assessment required in a death penalty proceeding. That's a very specific area where you're bringing in moral judgment and religious beliefs, right? That's not your average trial. And that's not bias. And the question before the court was whether or not it was prejudicial, not whether or not it was extraneous. And if I remember the distinction that the two of you drew, you believe that the fact that it came into the courtroom in a book, it was written, made it more prejudicial than if it was spoken, right? That was a question about prejudice, not a question of whether or not the information was extraneous. Whether or not information is extraneous is whether or not it's gone around the gatekeeping function of the trial court and come in through a back door. That's what makes it extraneous. I know this because you said that in Harlan. You said in Harlan, if I can quote, any information not properly received into evidence or included in court's instructions is extraneous to the case and the problem. Right? That's what makes it extraneous. And it's easy when it's a book or when the juror goes out and researches something on the internet, right? And goes out, gets all this new information, walks into the jury room during deliberation and says, hey, look what I found. That's easy. What's hard is when it comes in from inside the juror's head.
Well, no, what is the exception, though, that allows us to pierce, or any court, to pierce the deliberative privilege that goes on in the courtroom?
When the information is extraneous, prejudicial information. And in this case, it is. And let me explain to you why.
Okay.
I was getting there. I know I'm slow and I'm long-winded, and I apologize that I'm a lawyer. It's just one of the foibles that I have. As I was saying, it's difficult when it comes inside the juror's head. You know, the question is always, it gets confused. It's not that it's extraneous to the jury room. It's extraneous to the evidence that came in. And if it's inside the juror's head, it is still extraneous to the evidence that was admitted by the trial court. Period. The question becomes whether or not it's prejudicial, right? And looking at Kendrick v. Pippin and looking at destination travel is a really good way to figure out when it becomes prejudicial. Because we want jurors to bring information into the jury room inside their head. We don't want tabula rasa. We want jurors who know that ice is slippery So when the evidence is admitted at trial that there's ice on the sidewalk, they know that that was a dangerous condition. We want that, and that's good. What makes it prejudicial is when they take the evidence and they discard it. And they go, evidence, I don't need any of that which came in court. I know better. I have this other information that I'm going to replace the evidence with, and I'm going to make judicial fact out of what I know that did not come through the gatekeeping function of the trial court. That's the difference between destination travel, where the jury replaced the plaintiff's employee's salaries with the information he brought into the jury room from his prior experiences, right? And he brought that in and said, that evidence about the juror's salary, about the plaintiff's employee's salaries, forget that. I'll tell you what the appropriate salaries are. And this court found that that was improper because it replaced the evidence. Kendrick v. Pippin shows the opposite. When the jurors use the extraneous information as a magnifying lens to look at the evidence more carefully, more closely, and to come to a better rational decision, that's okay. That's what we want. That's what happened in Kendrick v. Pippin, and that's not what happened here. Here, the juror took this bias, took this prejudice, and said, evidence in court? I don't need that. I know he's guilty. He's Mexican. From my law enforcement experience, I know better. They have bravado. They're guilty. And all the evidence that occurred in the trial, out the window. That's what makes it extraneous prejudicial information. Throw out the evidence.
Mr. Rosen, obviously repugnant statements. If we allow this, where do we draw the line? I mean, because then it's, I didn't like the look of the guy, or, you know what, men. I mean, we're speaking of ice and slippery slopes. Where do we draw the line?
And, you know, I don't think there is a slippery slope. And I think it's pretty clear and pretty easy. And again, I may be oversimplifying things inside my head. We have Batson. We have the Fifth Amendment. We already have recognized classes of bias which are not permitted in a courtroom. Just take that, what we already have, and we use that. And jurors shouldn't be able to discriminate against parties any more than parties should be able to discriminate against jurors. The same classifications apply. We're not writing on a blank slate, right? We're not making this up out of whole cloth. We already have a framework under the Fifth Amendment. And those exact same racial categories, they apply, and this is what we're talking about. You can't discriminate against somebody because they're Mexican-American, and I know that because that's what's been said in the Fifth Amendment context.
But in Batson, they talk about religion and gender. So absolutely. Do we extend it to that?
Oh, I know, because it could be the parade of horribles, right? Where does this all end? What will ever happen to jury verdicts? Right? 1961, before I was born, New Jersey Supreme Court in State v. Leavitt allowed an evidentiary hearing because there are anti-Semitic remarks made in the jury deliberation room during the process. Has New Jersey crumbled? Has a parade of horribles manifested itself there? Right? Look at all the cases that are cited in the briefs. All the different jurisdictions. Race-based, right? Religion-based. Where's the collapse of the systems? They profess there's a parade of horribles coming. Oh, beware. Be scared. Where is it? Where has it materialized in 50 years anywhere in America? It doesn't, and it happened. And this is why it doesn't happen. There's a fallacy. Let's start with the fallacies. Juror secrecy. During deliberations. Yes. After deliberations, where is that? Grand jury secrecy. There's a statute that tells us what happens in the jury room, grand jury room stays in the grand jury room. It's Vegas, right? Jury room, for normal proceedings, petit jury, no. There's no statute, and we tell jurors when they're done with their service, you can go out and you can talk to anybody you want about anything that happened in the jury deliberation room, your mental processes, your thoughts, why you did what you did. Everything can be exposed at that point once deliberations are over. There is no such thing as jury secrecy. It's a fallacy.
Well, do we have a trial about what the other jurors thought about these remarks? How do we know they just didn't totally disregard them because the guy was biased and off his rocker?
Absolutely. And that's why we have evidentiary hearings.
So we're going to try...
Is it a trial? No, it's an evidentiary hearing.
No, the factual determination the trial judge is going to make under your You're going to call in all the jurors and you're going to examine them whether or not the statements influenced their verdict?
Sure.
Why is it important if your theory, if your premise is you're entitled to a jury without any biased jurors, why does it make any difference what statements were made in the jury room? And I guess what I'm asking is, are you suggesting then that if one went outside and looked at comments made by the juror after or before that suggested he was biased, at least with regard to suspect classification, I guess you're suggesting, mm-hmm. that would also be grounds for upending a jury verdict?
Yes, I do. Absolutely.
So if you could find witnesses that said he's told racial jokes before.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And he,
bias, prejudice, is a state of mind. You can't look at a person and say he's racist, he's not racist. You have to wait until they say something, unless they're going to go goose-stepping into the jury room. Right? It all comes down to analyzing the juror's state of mind. Are they a racist? And that's why they're too, I mean, you typically refer them to explain this additional information. There's a whole other purpose for this evidence. Right? And that is circumstantial evidence of a state of mind, of actual bias. That's what we're talking about. Is the juror racist? And I think in America, in Colorado, in the year 2014, we should not have racially prejudiced jurors. I think that there is an affirmative obligation on all of us as members of the judiciary to do something to stop it.
I guess what this leads to, in my mind, in terms of the constitutional argument, is does the constitutional protection, the guarantee of an impartial jury, refer to procedures that the state imposes designed to get you that kind of a jury? And you seem to be arguing that no, it actually means that you can establish that any juror was not impartial in some way based on things that happened before or things that happened after. That would indicate that your right to an impartial jury has been violated. That does seem to be pretty broad.
Yes. Yes, it does. And I think it's deserved. You read the cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, you read the cases from this court, and they use words, really great words, about how odious and pernicious racial prejudice is in the system. We need to do something. And yes, it's going to create problems. There is no solution that is perfect. Just like defendants aren't guaranteed a perfect trial, I don't guarantee you a perfect solution. That's what we're talking about, is balancing this out and being willing to accept some risk and stepping up and doing the right thing. And you know why? Because you're the judiciary. You are the face of the judiciary. And if not, you then who?
Counsel, if we were to disagree with your argument that this type of information can come in under the exception for 606. Let's just say we disagree with that and say it doesn't work. It bars this type of information. Can you move a little bit to the constitutional argument? And I'd like you to address what the U.S. Supreme Court has laid out as its factors in Tanner and why that is inadequate to protect what happened here.
Yes. And I don't want to beat a dead horse too much. Judge Taubman did such a nice job in the dissenting opinion explaining why the Tanner factors don't work. I laid them out in the brief itself. I don't believe they're better effective for stopping racial bias and prejudice again because you can't see it as compared to alcohol and drug usage, which was the issue in Tanner, right? It wasn't a bias case. Tanner wasn't bias. Tanner was drug and alcohol use, and whether or not the jurors were so drunk and out of a gourd that they couldn't render a valid verdict, right? That's not bias. This is very different. And you can't see bias.
And the reason I raise this is you framed the question, I thought this was interesting. You said, what's at stake here is whether we had a biased juror sitting in the, mm-hmm. on the jury. And that's the very same question that we'd be asking up front in the voir dire process in order to try to ferret out mm-hmm. those
30 jurors and make sure they don't sit on the jury to begin with.
Yes.
And to me, the biggest tool in the toolkit for that is the process of voir dire.
Agreed.
So why is that inadequate in this context? Why is voir dire inadequate?
It's inadequate because a racist is so unlikely to step up in open court and say the things he said in the jury deliberation rooms. What is the likelihood that he is going to stand up in open court in front of a judge and actually say those things? It is incredibly unlikely. Even if they are actually aware of their bias and consider it to be a bias, which is unrare, which is so unusual because most biased people don't have self-awareness, their ability to say it out loud in open court is de minimis. This is not just me talking about the inadequacies of TANA, okay? Every single court that has...
Can I just pick up on that? Because I'd really like to bring this. I understand exactly where you're coming from. But my question is, let's assume you're correct, that biased juror is not going to answer truthfully, and yet then make statements such as what happened here. In that situation, couldn't you argue that the TANA factors, in fact, didn't protect in that balancing between, you know, protecting the secrecy of jury deliberations versus enforcing or assuring the right to an impartial jury? And where the TANF factors fail to protect, could that not be seen as an exception then, allowing that type of information to come in?
That analysis makes sense. I understand that analysis. I don't particularly agree with it, but I understand it. And it's not just me disagreeing with that. The court in Villar, the First Circuit, in 2009, said TANF factors were not appropriate. Kittle, the D.C. Circuit Court in 2013. Massachusetts Supreme Court, Commonwealth v. McCown, 2010. Rhode Island, in Ohio Law and Brown, in 2013. And Fleshner v. Pepos in Missouri, in 2009. It's not just me saying Benally was wrong. You'd be the only other court in America to agree with Benally if you like, he said the TANF factors are just fine. And if you would like Colorado to stand next to Benally, and you think that that is appropriate for the state of Colorado, there's not much I can say, other than I think it's just flat out wrong.
What do you understand the rule in VR and the DC case to be? Because as I looked at those cases, I had a hard time understanding what rule they were proposing and how we would actually implement such a rule.
And it's hard. And again, I'm not offering perfect solutions. Anybody who does is selling you something. Don't believe me. What they looked at was that there should be this rare exception for the unusual case where we have such strong evidence of racial bias coming into the jury deliberations that we have to do something. Because it just strikes at our notion of fundamental fairness. And there's no clear black and white answer on this. There's no litmus test. There's no bright line I can give you. But the courts on a daily basis don't engage in bright lines. They look at the totality of the circumstances. They weigh, they balance, they measure. That's why we have evidentiary hearings. That's why they do interview witnesses and make credibility determinations, so that they can make the difficult decisions that we need to make based on evidence, not on speculation or bias, right? And if you look at those cases, I think that this case falls within those that talk about the rare and unusual circumstance and fits the exception that Villar and Kittle and Brown talk about. If you look at the contents of the affidavits themselves, they are repugnant, they are abhorrent. And it's not just that. It's not just, I hate him because he's Mexican. It's, I think he's guilty of the charge that he has been charged with because he is Mexican, which is a whole different thing than if the juror just said something along the lines of, I don't like those people, their houses smell funny, right? That would be a whole different look at the bias and how it might have impacted the jury.
Don't you think there's an irony in your argument that the jurors who swore those out probably took offense at those remarks and that the result indicates that independent judgment was exercised inside the jury room, and we have to presume that the verdict conscientiously followed the instructions, which are look at the evidence and follow the instructions. That's how you should reach a verdict.
Well, that's, of course, the presumption. In the absence of other evidence, that is a presumption, but it is not an irrebuttable presumption. In this case, we have evidence that at least one juror didn't follow the evidence and didn't follow the court's instruction and didn't live up to their oath. And that presumption, if we say it's ironclad and can never be broken, what are we saying about the fairness of trials? That we'll just ignore evidence of unfairness when it's presented to us? We have presumptions, and that's okay. We should have presumptions. And jurors should be presumed to follow the law and the instructions of the court. But when they don't, we should do something. And this is that rare and unusual circumstance.
Well, if we try to fashion a rule that accounts for particularly egregious moments, then aren't we inviting investigators to essentially bang on all jurors' doors after the fact? Because you never know what you might unearth?
Of course. Harassment. And going after the jurors.
Well, I don't know about harassment, but it would incentivize a lot of post hoc knocking on doors, seeing what you might be able to get in the form of an affidavit so you can have a hearing for a new trial. I mean, that's inevitable, don't you think, if we were to start down this path?
Well, and again, that's the myth. Show me where it's happened. In all the jurisdictions that allow these type of evidentiary hearings, where has that happened? That is a myth. And I call it a myth because Justice Hobbs tells me it's a myth. In the Stewart opinion, you describe the safe zone that is created by the trial court's instruction to the jurors, after the trial, which tells them you are free to talk about your deliberations with anybody you want. And if anybody harasses you, they're belligerent to you, they come after you in any way, shape, or form, you tell me, trial judge, and I will put an end to it. I will put an end to it right away. And I can tell you, as trial counsel, the last thing I'd ever want is the trial judge thinking I was tampering with jurors after a verdict. Lose my law license, face felony charges. That's the safe zone that's created. I know the story that's out there about the harassment of jurors and the parade of plaintiff's attorneys going or defense attorneys going after them.
Well, it's not so much harassment as it is, you know, even a more benign chilling effect is what I'm trying to capture.
I still don't see it. I just don't. I just don't. And that's all I can say about it.
Right.
And there's no evidence of it. Right. At this point, with 4 minutes and 14 seconds left, unless there are any questions at this point, I would reserve the little bit of time I have left for a rebuttal, if I may.
You may. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Please, the court. Mr. Rosen says juror secrecy is a fallacy in the American judicial system. I would like to begin by quoting this court's statement in Garcia that the secrecy of jury deliberation is a core principle in the American system of justice. And this is not the only case, of course, that emphasizes the fundamental principle, that's a bedrock principle of American judicial system. Jury deliberation, the institution of the jury, cannot survive unless there is jury secrecy. Rule 606B is exactly designed to achieve that objective as one of the three fundamental principles that are identified in Stewart. Secrecy of the jury, finality of the verdict, and protecting jurors from harassment or any other form of intimidation that might discourage them from having a frank and open discussion during deliberations. So basically what we are dealing here is how to preserve that fundamental principle, the core principle of the American judicial system. Although the issue is framed as dealing with racial bias and the noble goal of eradicating racial bias, which is a worthy goal, but that is not what is suggested here by the defendant. It goes far beyond racial bias. As it was obvious from the questions, there is no limiting principle, and of course, as emphasized in Benally, There is no limiting principle to what is being suggested here. Opening up jury deliberations for to any kind of investigation regarding any protection of any constitutional right that is implicated here. I would like to just cite from the opening brief what is suggested here as being a principle to be adopted. Rule 606B is rendered unconstitutional if used to thwart a convicted defendant's ability to vindicate constitutional injustice. Any interpretation of Rule 606B that prohibits a court from considering evidence of statements made during deliberations that would vindicate a violation of a defendant's constitutional rights renders Rule 606B unconstitutional as applied. It is not limited to racial bias. It is not limited to bias at all. It involves any protection that is implicated in a constitutional protection. And that is the problem with this position. Because as the Tanner Court, the Supreme Court has indicated, once jury deliberations and jury secrecy is undermined, the system will suffer because it is based on jury deliberations being open and kept secret.
So does that mean there's no instance in which we should ever pierce that veil? Suppose you had, you can think of even more extreme examples, unfortunately, and I won't go through hypotheticals for fear of being offensive, but suppose everyone agreed with this gentleman and the entire jury was seen to be infected by racial animus. So what do you do with that?
It is a difficult balancing test. Of course, finale would be on the probably extreme spectrum in saying that probably even in that case, protecting the jury institution and secrecy does not allow us to invade jury deliberations even under those circumstances. However, there are other cases that try to create that imbalance between the interests of protecting impartial jury, the right to impartial jury versus jury deliberations. One case that this court has also used in Garcia, has relied on in Garcia, is the Thomas case, the Second Circuit case. In both the Court of Appeals case, Creo, and Garcia, Thomas has been used as providing one possible solution to this dilemma. Under this principle announced in Thomas, where the duty and authority to prevent defiant disregard of the law or evidence comes into conflict with the principle of secret jury deliberations, we are compelled to err in favor of the lesser of two evils, that is, protecting the secrecy of the jury deliberations at the expense of possibly allowing irresponsible juror activity. That is the conclusion of Thomas. However, Thomas also recognizes that when there is pervasive racism in the jury deliberation process, then there is a possibility of making an exception in that case. Under this principle, the need to preserve the secrecy of jury deliberations requires an investigation of juror misconduct to cease once any possibility arises that the jury is acting during deliberations based on his or her view of the sufficiency of the evidence. Of course, this was in the context of jury nullification, but the court went on to say that the same concern applies under 606B or post-verdict investigation. So that is a high standard, of course, but it addresses your concern that if we have an unusual and exceptional situation where there's no impartial juror on the panel, in the petty jury, and it is an extreme case, then maybe in that case there is ground to be involved in that kind of investigation.
You're going to have to explain that to me if you would. This is, would be a case where the evidence doesn't support the verdict, and it's just the result of whim, bias, animus, whatever. Why isn't the evidentiary check and the legal instruction the basic structural way that courts review whether or not we have a runaway jury that's, you know, a hanging jury of some sort? I mean, don't we have sufficient tools in the due process toolkit, you know, to see whether or not it's a verdict that's not supported by the evidence and ignores the instructions? What are you standing for when you say there may be an example of this, and how do we get into that where we start examining jurors, is what I'm asking you.
Of course, even the Thomas Court points out that there are other, and also Tanner is also emphasize that there are other ways to challenge when that situation happens, as you suggested, that if there is, no evidence that this evidence that the court, the verdict was not supported by any evidence, of course, that can be challenged.
Right.
But in terms of having a jury that completely ignores the impartiality, it is still an issue that can be addressed according to the Thomas Court. Even as long as there's a possibility, we don't deal with that. But if we assume that the Thomas Court solution would be workable, then it would be possible to say that maybe there is ground for investigation, an exception, making an exception to Rule 606B. But I would certainly agree with your position that is not it would be completely rare and exceptional that we cannot challenge it in other ways, and we have to resort to that.
Could you give me an example of what you're thinking about when you say that?
In terms of racial prejudice?
No, just a fact pattern that might fit what you're talking about.
I'm thinking in terms of discussions in the jury being centered on racial factors that may, to a large extent, influence the decision. And even though we cannot challenge it based on other factors, such as being completely against the evidence, but it is pervasive and to a large extent may be presumed to have significantly influenced it. Of course, we cannot, under 606, we get into that. But the hypothetical situation that is considered here under Thomas is that it is a rare case where there is no possibility that they were thinking of evidence. Of course, again, I think it is a rare exception, and whether it happens in reality or not, of course, we don't know.
I'm sorry. So if the jurors were just in the jury room making racist jokes, but not making any kind of racial insinuations with respect to the evidence, you would make that kind of a distinction?
It depends on the degree of the statement being made, as cases make clear. If there are just statements casually made, that does not provide sufficient support to say that we have enough evidence to pierce jury deliberations. It depends on the nature of influence that the racial remarks are presumed to have made. And I would emphasize again that under 606B, and if we apply a position like Tanner, it is almost impossible to do that, even though theoretically we may say that under some hypothetical situation it might be possible. But in reality, most of the cases that are addressing this issue, they deal with some casual remarks being made, or if there is a question even of not following instructions, the court still applies 606B by saying that as long as there is still some application of the evidence, considering the evidence, then it is not subject to piercing 606B.
But can I ask a question with regard to this rare exception line of thought? So what's the theoretical basis for why such evidence would be allowed of jury deliberations? Are you I take it when you're saying 606B wouldn't allow it, are you saying the rule would be unconstitutional in that kind of a situation?
Yes, it is, in considering the balance between 606B and the right to impartial jury. Those cases make exceptions in terms of creating that balance by saying that because of the constitutional implications of this kind of violation, then 606B would be limited. So only in that context would be the theoretical basis would be the interaction between the 606B exception, the 606B prohibition and the requirement of the Constitution.
But doesn't it be, I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
No, go ahead.
Doesn't it become circular? I mean, how do you expose the outlier if you apply 606B so rigidly in the first instance? How do you ever get to the rare situation?
In terms of what the evidence, how would you allow the evidence?
Right, how would you go about obviously, affidavits from jurors, you're not supposed to be looking at those. How would you ever expose this rare situation that you're postulating?
Obviously, there must be some evidence that there was racial or whatever violation that we're talking about. Of course, here it's a racial issue. The racial bias remarks were made in terms of how far the court will go into that investigation, and that is the determining factor. So there must be, obviously, at the beginning, some basis for deciding whether there is enough racial bias introduced into the jury deliberations before further investigation is necessary. If there is the allegation that, as Justice Weiss suggested, that everyone in the jury is being, for whatever reason, racist, that allegation raises the possibility of further investigation to determine if this is one of those rare cases or not. Even in this case, the court...
Rare cases, finish that thought. Rare cases that what?
That might open up the door for further investigation.
And what would you be looking for?
If we apply the Thomas principle, would be that if there is any possibility that despite those statements being made, despite those remarks, still there evidence was being considered in reaching the verdict instead of being completely independent of the evidence presented. As I was suggesting, in this case, the court looked at the evidence, looked at the two affidavits. So to that extent, it was addressing the issue whether there is enough evidence to pursue further the investigation into this issue. But that was not sufficient for the court for two reasons. First of all, the statement themselves did not indicate there was a pervasive intrusion, of racism into the deliberation. And secondly, those statements indicated that the issue of race, if there was any bias, the court did not need to further pursue that because that issue itself had not been addressed during voir dire. So once the court determined that, there was no further investigation either. Because of the nature of the evidence, the preliminary or evidence offered to the court did not require further investigation.
If I could follow up, I don't understand what the pervasive nature of this has to do with the constitutional right at issue. If you are willing to say that Rule 606 could be unconstitutional as applied because somehow it would violate the right to an impartial jury, why, where does the pervasiveness come in? Why, if you could show, as opposing counsel has said, that one juror was not impartial, why wouldn't the result be the same?
The question is, if, again, I'm suggesting that the principle announced in Thomas can be applied in the context of unusual circumstances where there is the possibility of complete undermining of the impartial jury principle. What makes it necessary is that if there is, again, there is no way that we, if there is no possibility that the juror followed the evidence, that would create a situation where the 606B would be in clash, would be conflict with the Supreme Court, with the constitutional requirement, Sixth Amendment bar. So the basis would be the evidence presented to the court to determine how pervasive that intrusion or that violation would be.
If I understand that distinction, are you suggesting then the right to an impartial jury doesn't mean the right to a jury that's not biased, but rather only the right to a jury that can be shown to have ruled against the defendant for reasons that were not related to the evidence, that were as a result of their bias? Is that the tie-in with the evidence?
Well, to some extent, yes. To the extent that there is a violation of constitutional provision, if we can conclude based on the evidence presented that this was a complete, ignorance, complete eradication of the principle of impartiality, that would be tying it with the requirements of 606B and reconciling 606B with the constitutional provision requiring impartiality.
Just the way that comes out sounding to me is an argument about whether it was really harmful, whether it really wound up convicting someone that would not otherwise have been convicted, rather than simply being entitled to jurors who are impartial. I guess I'm having a little trouble. I have a little trouble with your sticking in the word "complete" every time there. I'm not sure what that means. What's a partial violation of your right to an impartial jury and a complete violation?
That goes to the fact that there could be influences that, may not completely undermine a right to impartial jury. As far as we are looking at it from a perspective of jury deliberations, if overall deliberations can show that the jury looked at the evidence, reached a conclusion that can be supported by evidence, even though the interpretation or evaluation of that evidence may have been colored by some understanding of, or some kind of, impartiality, that would not undermine the fundamental fairness of the trial, even though it may not have been a perfectly impartial juror. So it is a matter of to what extent it undermined the principle of impartiality. Is it a complete case like, as Thomas suggested, that there is no possibility that they considered the evidence? Or is it a matter of they may not have been following, for example, the instructions or looking at the evidence completely impartial, but still they used some judgment of the evidence and reach that conclusion. It is a matter of degree of influence, yes, and it affects to what extent it could affect the outcome. When there is no consideration of the evidence, then obviously that can be challenged on other grounds because it completely undermines the validity of the verdict. When it is to some extent colored or influenced by that, the point is that 606B protects jury deliberations, even though it is not perfect, even though it is not completely you know, ideal in terms of following the instructions or staying away from racial partiality or racial bias. To that extent, then, we can say that 606B and the provision, the Sixth Amendment provision, can be reconciled if we follow what Thomas suggests. Of course, Benally, I would emphasize again that to avoid all these issues that we are talking about, Benally would suggest that once we have the Tanner, because the Tanner protections apply, we don't have to worry about that. As long as the voir dire is available to eradicate or to the extent that is possible.
Let's talk about voir dire. One of the issues we have here is how we expect defense counsel to conduct voir dire. On the one hand, some sensitive inquiry into racial bias, we've seen that done. But is it really fair to expect defense counsel essentially to ask people, are you a racist? Is that expecting too much of defense counsel in voir dire? Can you address that issue?
Yes. In order to make voir dire effective, of course, it depends on the strategy of the counsel, what option to pursue. But it is clear that there are cases where counsel decides to directly address issues of bias against, based on race or based on legal status, making specific questions such as, have you had any experience with this particular group of people? Do you have any feelings about them? Do you have any preconceived notions about them? Even in this case, the court was conscious of this possibility and asked counsel if counsel wanted to include some kind of questions, whether asked by the court or by counsel regarding the legal status of any witnesses. And counsel declined to do that. It is understandable counsel may not want to directly even pose these questions, but counsel can present the question to the court, and the court can answer it. Can ask the question in order to avoid the kind of confrontation that may result from that. But it is definitely possible to address it and, based on the answers given by jurors, determine whether it is a strong case of racial bias or not, use peremptory challenges to remove that particular juror, or in many cases the court can address it by asking, can you set aside the particular bias or prejudice that you have, and it is possible that the juror may sit it aside, and that is what is required under Colorado law, that if the juror declares that regardless of the opinion, preconceived notions that he has, he can sit it aside and base the judgment on the evidence, the court still should not consider that as unqualified. The juror is still qualified. Of course, it can be subjected to peremptory challenges. But certainly, voir dire can play a significant role in terms of identifying potential jurors and, based on that, deciding whether it is appropriate to apply peremptory challenges or challenges for cause.
And so, if in this case, let's say the topic was explored, had been explored in voir dire, but this particular juror gave no indication of any bias that would have flagged for defense counsel, a basis for challenge for cause or even for peremptory. And that juror then went ahead and sat on that jury, and then these affidavits come out. What happens under your approach in that situation? So, in other words, the topic was explored in voir dire, there was no indication of bias, and yet we have affidavits from other jurors indicating that juror, in fact, was biased.
That is precisely the question before the U.S. Supreme Court at this time in Wargers, whether jury deceit is sufficient basis for basically making 606B not applicable in this case because there is jury deceit. Again, under Benally, this would not be acceptable because still, it is piercing jury deliberations and undermining jury secrecy even there is, when there is jury deceit.
And there's no allegation in this case that there's jury
deceit. No, Your Honor, not the Court of Appeals affirmed the district court's conclusion that there was not sufficient
I was just looking at the questionnaire that this juror filled out, and it was very minimal information. But I didn't look at the voir dire. Was there anything more that went on in terms of the voir dire that would have suggested some of this was about?
Just general question in terms of whether this would be a good case for you if you in terms of general characteristics. But there is nothing specific about legal status or racial bias. And it is also important to note that this juror, even though made these statements in during the deliberations, he was in fact pursuing his interest in the case and trying to gather more information by talking to investigators. And one of the issues raised during the post-verdict motion is that he improperly contacted one of the police officers in order to get additional information regarding the policy for taking fingerprints from the ball to see that if that should have been done or not. So this juror had not decided, although these statements are problematic and repugnant, he did not make his decision before starting reviewing the evidence at jury deliberations, because he was interested enough, and in his mind at least, he was still open to the possibility of not finding the defendant guilty. And of course, the verdict supports that. The defendant was not convicted of the most serious charge that was brought against him, which is attempted sexual assault, but instead the lower counts of harassment and unlawful sexual contact. And another point of evidence I would like to emphasize is that the alibi witness, which is critical, and part of the argument is that juror 11 did not give credit to the testimony of this particular witness. He testified that defendant was with him from 8 to 10 p.m. that night. And not only do we have the testimony of the two victims who saw defendant both before going into the bathroom and saw him coming into the bathroom, which provides overwhelming evidence of his guilt, but the father of these children saw defendant taking off in his truck within minutes of this incident, which completely contradicts the alibi testimony that defendant was with him for 2 hours. So considering the evidence, the overwhelming evidence, it is clear that the defendant was not harmed based on any racial prejudice, or any statements made here, but it was based on the evidence presented to the trial that suggested that he was guilty.
You're finished.
Okay.
Thank you very much, sir.
I ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
All right. Now, let's see, Mr. Rosen, you have some time left. Looks like about 4 minutes.
Yes, sir. I'll try to move through this as quickly as I can. The Attorney General just stated that this juror, Juror 11, is the one who improperly contacted the police officers about the fingerprints and whether and why they lifted them off the light switch. I don't believe that's correct. I don't believe there's any evidence whatsoever in the record that this was the juror who did that. Okay, I think it was a different juror. The alibi witness and the overwhelming evidence of guilt, I couldn't disagree any more or more vehemently on that. His statement about the father seeing the defendant taking off shortly after the alleged crime and how that conflicted with the alibi witness's testimony is wrong. The officer, the gatekeeper, saw somebody driving off. The officer stopped that truck a short distance after and determined it was not Mr. Miguel Manny Rodriguez in the truck that they saw speeding off. They stopped that truck, and it wasn't him. And they found him, I think it was 90 minutes later, still on the premises, leaving the premises at that time. So no, it doesn't conflict with that. As to overwhelming evidence of guilt, we have two teenage girls who make a cross-cultural identification after seeing an individual for approximately 1 minute in the light, when they're subjected to a drive-by one-on-one shot where Mr. Pena Rodriguez is sitting on the curb, handcuffed. I would not call that overwhelming evidence of guilt. There's no physical evidence, there's no DNA, there's no fingerprints, there's no confession. He has never admitted to doing anything in this case. If that is overwhelming evidence of guilt, I have a respectfully disagree with that. As to some of the legal arguments that were just made, and the questions that were asked, it sounded like it was almost being advocated that there should be an insufficiency of the evidence analysis. If there's no evidence in the record that would support the conviction, therefore we can assume that there was racial bias in the case. Two things. One, we already have insufficiency of the evidence claims, and that's already a different area of law. Two, there's a requirement that the prosecution prove the charges beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence presented in court. Not a preponderance of the evidence, and then push it over the edge because of the bias. Justice Hood, you asked, and I'm not sure I understand the argument, so it's hard for me to talk about it. You asked, how can you ever explore this concept of a complete deprivation, and I'm misphrasing the argument, but it was a concept so short. But you were asking, how do you get that some evidence in the front end in order to make that type of analysis? And the answer is you can't. They promise you that you can, but you can't, because under Rule 606B, you can't get the initial evidence to meet the initial burden so that you can do a full explanation of the evidence later. It's setting up something that can never be achieved, because you can never get the evidence. The ability to vindicate constitutional justice. The rule should not prohibit the ability to vindicate constitutional justice. Those are words I chose. I chose them from Justice Bender. He used those in his dissent in Kazai, and I just like them, and I think it's true that we shouldn't have rules that prohibit the ability to vindicate constitutional justice. I've got 28 seconds, so at this time... I have one last thing I wanted to say. I almost forgot. I feel like I'm wrong. It was asked about what type of questions were asked the jurors, so I'm going to close on this. This is what defense counsel...